What is Defund the Police? Should police be answerable to the communities that they serve? And if so, how? Are there issues in current recruitment practices by law enforcement? These are just a few of the topics that we're going to cover today on the fifth episode of the Rights and Wrongs podcast. Welcome to the Rights and Wrongs podcast, the podcast where we talk about rights, privileges, and misconceptions. Today, talking about law enforcement, I am joined by Frank Scalise. I will let him introduce himself.
Hello, how are you doing? I am Frank Scalise. I am a retired police officer. I served 20 years in Spokane, Washington, which is in the eastern part of the state. I was fortunate to spend the first half of my career as a line officer and a detective doing the work of policing. And then the second part of my career, I moved into the leadership ranks, and so I got that perspective as well. I retired as a captain about 7 years ago. Right after retirement, I started teaching leadership for a course called Leadership in Policing that the International Association of Chiefs of Police sponsors. So I got to travel all over the U.S. and Canada talking to cops and civilians and law enforcement and teaching this rather intensive three-week course, which really helped my perspective as well. And then, of course, not being a cop for 7 years, I've had the advantage of a little bit of distance to sort of see things a little differently. In addition to that career, I'm also an author, write primarily crime fiction under the pseudonym Frank Zaffiro. And most of my books involve cops, and most of them take place in either my old hometown or its facsimile called River City. You know, one of the things I try to do in those books is to both show the humanity of the police officers, the reality of the work, but also to tackle some of the issues, the very real issues that we face today in policing.
All right. Thank you for joining us today. This is going to be kind of a bit of a continuation of the last episode that I had with Professor Di Giovanni. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked him, though. How do you feel about that buzzword, defund the police?
You know, you called it a buzzword, and I think that's a perfect way to describe it, because it's one of those things that means different things to different people. You know, I, as I mentioned, I spent 20 years in law enforcement, so, and then another 4 years going all around North America, talking to cops and interacting very closely with them. And in my experience, and granted, I'm clearly biased, but in my experience, 99% of those cops were dedicated, hardworking, good people who were there for the right reasons. And so that's where I'm definitely coming from. But I'm also coming from a position of having seen law enforcement both from the inside and outside, that we need reform in law enforcement. We need to reform how we police as a society. So when I hear defund the police, I know some of my friends in law enforcement that, you know, it's a trigger word, right? They hear cancel the police department, basically, right? And of course, some people might mean that, but I think the vast majority of people realize that that's a ticket to anarchy. And what they really mean is reform law enforcement, reform how we police. And that's what I mean when I say defund the police, or when I hear defund the police, I just immediately translate it in my brain to let's reform the way that we police in our country. Because clearly it's time. Clearly there have been mistakes, and there are functional pieces of the way we're doing things that just isn't working. Not for the communities that are being policed, some of them even more than others, and certainly not for many of the police officers themselves. They're struggling with a lot of things that could and should be changed in their world.
So you got onto the point of how a lot of cops go in for the right reason. I have a lot of friends that are across the different nations and different states of law enforcement. What do you think the biggest problems in recruiting? Because we talked about a little bit earlier, there is a recruiting shortage.
Yeah, I've been out of the job for 7 years, so maybe they've resolved it, but I kind of doubt it. for at least the last decade of my career, recruiting was a huge issue. And the reason is, there's a few reasons for that. One is the job is simply a very difficult job. And I don't just mean difficult in the way people might think because they watched crime fiction dramas or read books like the ones I write or seen the movies or whatever. You know, those psychological aspects that are dramatized are also very real. I mean, you deal with some bad things And I have some very bad memories of times of things I experienced in policing, and every cop does, some more than others, depending on their experiences. But it's not just that the job is psychologically difficult or dangerous, or that the danger isn't like explicit. It's always, you know, they're hovering. You never know when it's going to happen. That's part of what's so, you know, what grinds on you so much as a police officer. But it's also that the just the tasks being asked of the officers are many and varied. It's not a one-dimensional job like maybe it was, you know, or three-dimensional job. Maybe it was many, many years ago, or you had to be able to, you know, talk to people a little bit and fight, you know, or something, you know, back in the 40s or something. Now you're asking people to have a working knowledge of criminal law and keep it updated with criminal procedures, with new court findings and new changes to the way things are done or changes to the laws. You're asking them to be able to drive a vehicle safely and expertly in emergency conditions and everyday conditions, which is anybody who drives for a living knows the inherent danger of that. You're asking them to be computer savvy, both with databases and being able to write a not just a coherent report, but a report that becomes the report of record, and upon which, you know, these sometimes monumental court cases can turn on how that record was done. You're asking them to be able to investigate a crime scene, collect evidence, be able to talk to a 5-year-old who's just been molested, or a 95-year-old who's just had their house broken into, or a hardened suspect who just did one of those two things, and everybody in between, and still be able to get out of their car and chase somebody down a dark alley and roll in that alley fighting with them and win, or at least hold out until backup gets there. So it's not a one-dimensional or even a three-dimensional sort of ask. It's a very multifaceted job requirement. And so, frankly, part of the recruiting issue is that the number of people who are qualified to do this job, because on top of all of that, you have to have sound character and be psychologically stable and be medically fit and all of that. And so the number of people who can do that within our society has diminished as the job has become more complex. And then you have to have somebody who wants to do it. So forget people who maybe it's not their calling. It just isn't. There are more and more people who look at the job and they see how tumultuous it is. They see how political it's become. They see the dangers that exist in terms of being sued, in terms of all of that. And there simply were maybe a generation or two generations ago, they would have been signing up and taking the exam. They're not even considering it now. And so you have this recruiting issue, and how do you resolve that?
Well, I find it fascinating because you bring up multiple different issues, like having to be able to talk to a 5-year-old and a 95-year-old. And the biggest thing in law enforcement is when you're making an arrest, but you have to maintain chain of evidence. Mm-hmm. And the hardest thing, like I remember this from working in the military, I used to help the SACO by doing your analysis tests. So mm-hmm. I was the guy that had to follow you into the bathroom and make sure that you, but you
that
have to make
like
sure.
A fun job.
It's a fun job, but you have to do every single, you have to say the same thing to every single person, do the same motion, and it's very repetitive. Mm-hmm. And it even can become taxing with Marines who are every single, not I don't want to say everyone's the same, but it's basically the same person doing this time and time again. But if you say one thing differently with one Marine and they fail their test and you said something different to them, they did, that evidence is now completely kaput. And you're talking about, we're having to deal with people from various backgrounds, different languages. I can speak a little bit of other languages and like I know, even though I think I'm translating what I'm trying to say correctly, I'm probably not. And it's a lot right there. The next thing was the whole entire idea of education, because you brought up about like computer analysis and all this. One thing I found frustrating before I went for my master's, I was applying to a lot of police departments. I went through the hiring process for a police department in Vermont, actually. Passed the test, passed the physical. I just couldn't pass the polygraph. I guess I'm one of those people with a guilty conscience and I have like physical claustrophobia, so having to sit still like freaks me out.
A polygraph is a great tool, and polygraphers will swear by it, most of them, but in my experience it's a great tool, and it's right enough of the time that it can aid you in your investigation, but it's not ironclad. It's not you know, it's not 100%. And I failed a polygraph once while I was in the military as well, and like you probably were, I was very frustrated because I knew I was telling the truth and I couldn't figure out why it was coming up differently. And I talked to one of the polygraphers at my agency about it years later, told him about the frustration and how the guy handled it. And, you know, his answer was that when something like that occurs, it's usually the polygrapher or the person reading the chart. It's not necessarily you.
One of my professors was a polygrapher for the CIA, and he said, like, I'm probably one of those people with a guilty conscience, because it's, have you ever done anything wrong? And it's just like, you stole candy when you were 5 years old, and like, that still gnaws at you.
Everything I've ever done was wrong.
No, yeah. It's just what it's like. That's,
but you were
that's...
talking about your frustrations with the hiring process, and I'm assuming with your education, not as large a factor as maybe it should have been.
Oh, yes. Thanks for getting me back on track. One thing that people have always known me to be very vocal about
is, I think we give too much preference in like local hiring to veterans and not enough to education. Because I've always found it a little sad. I have friends that have college degrees, like dual bachelors, but because of the fact that they can't get 115 on the Massachusetts test, they can't beat the guy that got a 90 or something, like got that extra 15 mm-hmm. points or whatever. And it's not saying that veteran service doesn't help, but like I was an electrical engineer in the Marines. How does that help me become a cop?
I don't think it's I think it's a little bit about respecting that the military experience elements of it might translate well to police work. But I think that might be half of it. I think the other half is just flat out a veteran's appreciation is really what it comes down to. And I think I'm with you in that it's probably more heavily weighted than it should be. The educational requirements for agencies at the state, local, and federal levels really vary. I mean, there are some departments, at least, you know, there were last time I looked, that if you have a high school diploma, that's enough. You can apply. Others require a certain amount of college or certain courses. I think when I was hired in Spokane, I think you had to have 90 credits, and you had to have the entry-level English courses as part of that 90 credits. Others require, you know, or give credit for four-year degrees. And there's value in education, certainly. There may be more value in education than veteranhood, says the guy who had about like 91 credits when I applied, you know, and got the bump for being a veteran, you know. So I'm not trying to pull up the ladder here, but there's truth that, you know, education does help a lot. And it's one of these age-old arguments. I saw it a lot when I was teaching after I retired, that whole concept of the academic and the practitioner. You know, and the practitioners don't want to listen to the academic because you've only been in the classroom or the laboratory, and it doesn't work that way in the real world. And they're right. It doesn't always work that way in the real world, but it sometimes does. And it definitely helps. And then, of course, the academic who sees the practitioner as a knuckle dragger that, you know, won't listen to progressive or new ideas and so forth, which is also inaccurate. The real truth is somewhere in the middle where you apply some of both.
Yeah, and that's where I've always looked at it. I think I'd have less of an issue with it if it was balanced. Like, they gave the same amount of preference to the vet as they did the education. But, like, that's the whole thing. Because, like, everyone says, oh, if you have the education, you're going to test. But it's just, like, you can't get that. You can only score 100 if you not have that extra preference. And the other thing I was thinking was, like, the FBI. Because the FBI pushes very hard to get lawyers, people with, like, computer engineering degrees and all this stuff, which is really great for their stuff. But it just seems like after I graduated my bachelor's and my minor in sociology, it's like, I've got this bachelor's in criminal justice. But right. It doesn't seem to matter if I go fed, state, or I don't want to say a pointless piece of paper, but in the hiring process. I was wondering if you had any view on that.
Yeah, I mean, I value education. I mean, I got my undergraduate degree while I was a police officer working full time in history, and then got my master's degree in administration of justice, you know, about 10 years after that when I was still on the job. And so, I, you know, clearly I value education. My wife's a teacher. You know, my oldest son is studying to be a teacher. You know, a lot of people in my family teach. And so I value education, and I do think it should be more balanced. One of the, I'm all about supporting our veterans, and I mean, I am one. I served in the military, and I value people who have done that. And I think you should get a little bit of a bump. And at the same time, one of the interesting things about giving veteran preference to police candidates is then you have perhaps a disproportionate number of people within your organization who are veterans, who have a military background. And there are very many good things that come of that. They understand chain of command. They understand discipline. They understand rules and regulations and so forth. But there has been, over the course of the last 30 or 40 years, to my mind, a little bit too much militarization of the police in general. And that, I think, hand in hand with the war on drugs that began back in the Nixon presidency, has really created a mentality that I don't know is necessarily the healthiest one for the relationship between the police and the community. And that has to be a healthy relationship. That is the relationship. I watched listened to the podcast you had with Professor D. Giovanni. And one of the things that was pointed out on that episode, among a number of really great points, it's well worth a listen if you haven't listened to it yet. But one of you pointed out, you know, Sir Robert Peel and his tenets regarding policing. And the most basic one is that the police are the public and the public are the police. And that's maybe not an exact quote. I may be turning those around, but that's a paraphrase. The idea being that the police are not separate from the public. And through the war on drugs, which I'm not pro-drug. I don't think all drugs should be legalized. My friends that are listening to this are on the department are probably thinking I've gone around the bend on this, and I certainly haven't. But, you know, the war on marijuana was stupid, let's face it. I mean, and I, when I was teaching after I retired, marijuana started becoming legal in first, Colorado and then Oregon and Washington. And of course, I was living in Washington and then now in Oregon. So, there's a pot store on the corner. If you want to go in, you can. It's not my thing, but, you know, I mean, other people, if it's your thing, great. And so a lot of cops that I knew and the cops that I encountered where it wasn't legal yet felt like it was Armageddon. It was going to be a disaster. It was going to be awful. And I just had to tell them, look, I mean, on the job, how many times did you ever have to fight with a stoner, with somebody who was stoned? Like, how many fights did you get in with somebody who was smoking marijuana? The answer is 0 point something. I guarantee it. You didn't even have to chase them. I mean, if you chased them and they ran off, you didn't even have to go after them. You just rattle the bag of Doritos and they'd come back. I mean, I'm not saying that any drug that is abused isn't hurtful. It certainly is. Alcohol is a great example, but it's legal. Pot's legal too. How many resources did we waste arresting people for possession of pot, possession of paraphernalia, possession of small amounts? Now, I'm not talking about the violence around the drug distribution trade that's going on. I'm not talking about that. That needs to be addressed. That needs to be policed. That's where the focus should be. And I feel the same way about the harder drugs as well. Not that they should be legalized, but that our focus should be on those elements. Because, you know, George, we have focused on punishing users rather than maybe giving them some rehab, maybe treating them. And not everybody's going to be treatable. Not everybody's going to get kicked a drug and not be on it anymore. I'm not an idealist. I'm a realist. You're going to have a failure rate. But if you treat those people rather than arrest them and throw them in jail and focus your arresting, because you have a limited amount of time in the day and resources to apply. If you apply those more to the distribution level and to where the violence is actually happening, I think our enforcement of drug laws would be more effective. And that's just kind of where I'm at on it these days.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's actually interesting living in the UK because I didn't know till 6 months living here that I didn't know weed was illegal in the UK. Because
it's illegal?
Yeah, it's illegal in the UK, but they kind of treat it the same way Massachusetts does because it's now legal in Mass. But they don't treat it as like heavy as a class one narcotic like we do in the US. If you get caught with weed, it's kind of like underage drinking. It's more of a slap on the wrist. Like, don't, like, the cops are going to be like, hey, put that out. Don't do it here.
It's a nuisance crime more than anything, is what you're saying.
Yeah, to them, like, that's what it is. Like, it's not legal. You can have your argument if it should or shouldn't be, but it's how it's treated here. It doesn't really matter. It's such in that gray area that it's just like, it doesn't. And like, that's how it should be treated. It's also interesting where we're talking about the veteran thing. I was thinking about this right now is I have friends that are Icelandic and I have friends that are Finnish from two Nordic countries. my friends from Iceland never have met anyone that served in a war zone because, like, they don't basically have a military. So, like, they don't have these issues. I think they've had one shooting in their entire, in the last 50 years with police involvement.
They just don't play that game. They're like, we're out.
Well, it's because, like, they just, like, we're a little Viking island. It's like, no one's going to mess with Iceland. They're just that. But then you go to Finland, it's mandatory for all men to serve in the military, basically. You can get out of it, but it's mandatory. So it's just interesting we're having this conversation. Like, this is a very American conversation when you think about when it comes to policing.
Sure. And I will say, in defense of Finland's policy, if you live next door to Russia for all those years, you probably want to have a standing military, you know.
Yeah.
Or you'd be a Russian province pretty soon.
And, no, I'm not disagreeing with it, but it's just a very interesting...
It forms your national culture, though, right? Yeah. And it's formed police culture, too, because you can feel how you want about the war on drugs and where our assets, where our resources should be placed and how we should approach it. And you can even call me a hypocrite if you want to, because I've arrested people for possession of drugs and in the past. And so I'm not saying that I've been perfect either. But if you can argue all you want about that, but declaring war on anything as a police culture and ramping up the militarization of the police, it has had the byproduct, I think, of really estranging a lot of police departments from the community that they serve. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of this that I'm a writer, and any writer out there, you know, admires other writers when they do a great job of bringing something, you know, truth out through their fiction. And I'm a huge fan of David Simon's television show, The Wire, largely recognized as one of the best police dramas, if not one of the best television dramas of all time. I mean, don't ask Sopranos fans because they'll fight you over it, but The Wire is really good. And one of the things it's really good about is it does tackle these sociological questions and these policing questions. And there's a real great scene in there where this is discussed, and it's a major named Bunny Colvin who's talking to an acting lieutenant named Carver, and he's talking about this militarization of the police. And he essentially says, look, if you see yourself as a soldier, then you start to see everybody else in terms of that. So they're either an enemy soldier or a non-combatant civilian. And the area that you police becomes occupied territory. I mean, it's a psychological discussion that he's having that I think has some merit. And people who have looked at this much more closely than I have written about it. And I think that approach has bred this warrior cop mentality. And you and I talked about this before the show. I am in favor of the warrior cop. Don't get me wrong. I used to have in my locker every day when I'd open it up when I was on patrol, you know, I had a little self-positive self-talk thing to kind of a...
You have that in your first book. Your first book, it has it goes on. Yeah. At the end of it, like, yeah. I'm like warrior in mind, body, and spirit. And the end of it, which was really important, was I will survive.
Right. And I didn't make that up. That was preached to me, rightfully so, at the academy. Listen, you may not like this, but the fact is, a police officer, he or she has to be a warrior at some point. The problem I see is they don't have to be a warrior every moment. And what I mean by this is there's a movement that's kind of floundered in a lot of police cultures to shift to what they call a guardian model. And that guardian model, there's a little bit of disdain for that among some of the more traditional police officers who are like, no, I'm a warrior. Well, yeah, you are. And you have to be. There are times where you're going to be in that alley rolling around with somebody bigger, stronger, meaner, and more motivated than you. And you have to be able to rise to that occasion. But that's not every moment of your police career. And living in that moment or in expectation of that moment throughout your entire career, in every moment of that career, really creates an outlook and a way that you interact with people that maybe isn't as healthy as it could be. I'll give you an example. I don't think anybody would argue that the samurai were great warriors. I think you have to respect them. But while they lived by the blade and Bushido was their code and they were completely, that was their life. It wasn't all about the sword every moment. You know, they wrote poetry. They did calligraphy. They did flower arrangements. I mean, they did artistic things as well. And then when the sword needed to come out, when it was time, they were the consummate warrior. And I'm not suggesting we need to send our police to calligraphy class and have them, you know, bring flowers to work and arrange them. What I am saying, though, is that you can be a guardian. You can be together with that community and have that approach. And then when the time and have that warrior mindset in terms of awareness, and when something happens where you have to bring out that warrior, you do, and you take care of business. And obviously, sometimes that's an ugly scene. We've seen many examples of legitimate uses of force that are still ugly. I mean, it doesn't look good when you have to use force on someone, but it is occasionally a part of the job. And you want someone, look, put it to you this way, George, the better I am at the physical side of policing, at defensive tactics, the more quickly I can take control of you as the suspect, the safer it is for both of us. And so having an adept warrior element to your police officers, all of them, to some degree or another, is important. But you don't have to live in that moment constantly. And I think when you do, it breeds that psychology of that warrior mindset in terms of the war on drugs and the militarization of the police, and everybody's an enemy or a sheep that I have to protect, or maybe I don't know which yet, so I have to be super vigilant. This throws up a lot of obstacles to healthy human interaction. And you bring ultimately up, that's what we want.
You bring up a few great points, because it does bring back to the whole entire thing where we're talking about good aspects from the military. And like, there's a few things like I got from one of my NCOs, who was my corporal, then my sergeant. And he taught me something that's really important, which you talk about with the samurai, is he knew how to teach us when you're the uniform and in the uniform, that's one thing. The second this uniform comes off, it's 5 o'clock. That doesn't come back till 07. He knew how to split. And it sounds weird having a split personality, but you have to sometimes, especially with jobs like law enforcement, which is hard, you have to leave it at the office.
You can't. You really can't. You're absolutely right. You have to. It is extraordinarily difficult. This is why police burn out, because of hypervigilance, because they can't leave the job behind. Part of the reason is, as a police officer, and you're held to a much higher standard than the average butcher, baker, or candlestick maker that you live with in that community. And that's entirely appropriate. As much as it sucks when you're the police officer and you're constantly having to be vigilant about your own behavior, you know, you can't get drunk in your backyard and scream, or you shouldn't, you know, and certainly it's altogether correct for us to hold people to a higher standard when we've given them greater responsibility and authority. I'm not opposed to that at all, but it does have a psychological impact. And so turning it off is difficult in law enforcement. Now, there are ways to do that. And, you know, one way that it was encouraged is don't necessarily surround yourself with only other cops in your friend circle. You know, have friends who are outside of the career field. It does help keep you grounded. It does help you maybe not be in that mindset 100% of the time. But that's a difficult proposition, because, you know, not everybody understands what the experience is like. They don't understand why you're being hypervigilant. They don't understand why this makes you frustrated, or why you're being wary of this person, or why maybe you're keeping a very stony visage and not showing your emotion. There are very legitimate reasons why the police respond this way, and they're not malevolent or anything like that. It's just a regular psychological reaction, but they get interpreted, you know, that this cop is arrogant, you know, he's an asshole, she's, you know, stone cold, whatever. And again, another barrier to human interaction that has consequences. The idea of community-oriented policing is all about the police and the community working together. And all the things that we've been talking about, many of them are obstacles to that, psychological obstacles. I would like to see law enforcement move to a model that reinforces the psychology of community, of being part of it. And don't get me wrong, they have in many places, parts of departments, sometimes whole departments have done this. I'm speaking in generalities. And so, of course, there are exceptions. There are a minority of exceptions. There's a good number of them. In my own agency, when I came on, community ordering policing was the catchphrase, and it was being pushed really hard. And quite frankly, because I came up in that warrior mentality, because, you know, it was the 90s, so 20 years of the war on drugs have been going on, the militarization of police through equipment and mentality had time to hit its stride. And so I wasn't down with that. I mean, I you could do that if you want to. I want to drive fast and chase bad guys and take them to jail. That's what I don't do. Yeah, I want to help people. Every cop says, I want to help people. That's why I want to be a police officer. And 99% of them are telling the truth. But how do you want to help people? Well, I guarantee a lot of us, and I was one of these people, wanted to help people by chasing bad guys and taking them to jail. We wanted to be warriors for and help people by protecting them and by fighting against the bad guys. This was how we saw it. And there's a place for that. There's an element of that. There's a percentage of that that has to take place. But we had some disdain for community-oriented policing. Some of the first officers who embraced it, there was a position we had called an NRO, a neighborhood resource officer. And this was a cop who would go into a neighborhood. They'd work out of the substation there, the community-based substation.
We had one of those. Yeah, I remember them.
It's a great model, but we had contempt for those officers when they first started. I mean, they weren't neighborhood resource officers. The NROs were not really in officers. We were jerks about it, to be honest with you, because they weren't fitting that mold that we had all been brought up to believe in, that was being reinforced, of that warrior cop mentality. Now, when a couple of officers who had cachet, who had credibility, street credibility, when they stepped into those roles and you could call them leaders in doing this, they had the courage to say, yeah, I want it. This model could work. I'm going to try it. When they stepped into it and they started getting results, sometimes the same results that maybe these more empty holster officers, as we thought of them, were getting as well. But now it's, you know, this guy or this gal who we respect, it's getting those results. It started changing some minds. And so community-oriented policing, it absolutely can work. It has to work. That's how we have to police. It has to be in conjunction with the community. You can't effectively police without the community involved, because quite frankly, the community should be telling you what they want out of policing. Now, notice I didn't say how to police, because, you know, the police are professionals just like the firefighters and the doctors and the lawyers. I mean, a different kind of professional, different schooling requirements, obviously, but you don't tell an expert how to do their job. You tell them the result that you want. Like, you go to your doctor and you say, I want this to stop hurting. And the doctor tells you, take this pill, or we need to do an operation, or keep it still for a week, or whatever, because he's a professional.
I want to come back to that. But also, when you're going back talking about community policing as well, it is really important that people remember. It is one thing I'll talk about it a lot, but like here in Scotland, there's one police department. Right. The department here in Glasgow is the same one in Dundee, the same one in Stirling.
Right.
The United States, we have over 50,000 police departments. And just because, while community policing will look differently where my parents live in Scotland, Neck, North Carolina, compared to where I grew up in Quincy, but there also is that whole argument where you're talking about the old school, which is more like the broken windows theory. And broken windows theory has its place in parks, in subway stations, like where it famously got perfect with like the subway station they try to implement it across all New York City. Problem is there's not really a community in the subway. That's just people passing through. When you try and put it in a neighborhood where people live there, you can't really enforce, you can't enforce broken windows theory, but that's how you get a lot of the 80s riots. And
yeah, I mean, it depends on how you go about it. I think there's no one answer, right?
Exactly.
There's no pill that we can all take and everything will be fine. It's multiple things, and it's how these things interact that has to be balanced and has to be looked at. Because, you know, I mean, to draw an analogy, when I was pretty early on in my career, is when the pepper spray OC-10 became a tool that the police were using, and we were issued this. And I hated that stuff. I just could not stand it. And overspray was always an issue, and I hated it. But
everything tastes like copper afterwards.
Yeah, it's just awful. I mean, but the thing about it is, when it first came into use,
you know, the people who were proponents of it were like, this is it. You'll never have to fight somebody else again. They put up their fists and start to come at you. You spray them. They fall down and cry. You help them wash their eyes out and take them to jail. That'll happen every time. And it's the, you know, it's cop in a can, you know. Now I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there was a lot of confidence placed in this as being a cure-all. And now we won't have to shoot anybody. Now we won't have to use our batons on anybody in a fight. We won't have to use fists or feet or grappling. Because we'll just get compliance with this new tool. It's the one size fits all. And of course, that's not the case. It never is. The same thing happened with tasers. Are tasers a very valuable tool? Yes. Do they work? Most of the time, they work very efficiently. Do they cause great injury? Well, a lot less than a bullet, and usually no lasting damage at all. And do you get compliance? Very often, yes. Do they work 100% of the time? No. They do not, because it's not the only solution. But if you have a taser and you have pepper spray and you have this tool and that tool and you know how to, I don't know, talk to someone, which cops are notoriously good at and don't get credit for most of the time, then now you might have an answer that works a vast majority of the time. And so if you take that analogy and throw it into the larger equation of what we're talking about, does broken windows theory have a place there? Is it a tool on the belt? You bet, because when people live in a place that they're proud of, they behave differently than when they live in a place they don't care about. And if you have an area that has a sense of community versus one that doesn't, people behave differently. They interact differently. So is that a tool that should go on the tool belt? Absolutely. It's not the one thing that's going to fix everything, you know, and that's what we have to realize. And we have to have a little patience about is finding out which tools we need to apply. And when and where and how they need to be applied is a difficult process, and it doesn't happen overnight. Everybody wants an immediate, like, put it in the microwave and I get my satisfaction. I get my dinner. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't even work that way when you have a bad situation happen where police do something they shouldn't do, or where it looks like they did something they shouldn't do, and the community is up in arms over it. I salute those people who get upset and point and say, that's wrong, or I don't understand that, or I want an explanation for that. They deserve that. It's their police department. It's their community. It's someone from their community that they're talking about. But that doesn't happen overnight. I mean, an investigation takes time. And as one of my friends who was a homicide detective, bit of wisdom that he repeats that any homicide cop out there said a million times, you only get one shot at a crime scene. You only get one shot to investigate a crime correctly. And so you have to be meticulous. You have to take your time. You have to do it with an eye toward getting to the truth and getting all the facts, not to getting it done as quickly as you can or finding something that makes people happy. That's not the purpose of an investigation. And people get frustrated with that. And I understand that. But that is one of the tools on the belt, a proper investigation of police events, whether they're misconduct or whether they are completely justified and the officers did everything right. A complete, thorough, and eventually transparent, if not transparent, you know, even before the end of the investigation, depending on the situation. That's what people want. That's what people need. That's what they deserve. But they don't deserve a microwave answer. They don't deserve, you know, it to happen like that. Because if it happens like that, then it's probably going to be fraught with problems. There's a sheriff that I won't mention that was, you know, fond of when something would happen with a deputy that looked problematic or the accusation was ugly, he'd fire him. Boom, just like that. Made people super happy out in the community because they're like, hey, he's responsive. He's doing the right thing right away. And some of those times, that would have been the right thing after the process has been gone through. It would have been the right answer. But the problem is if you don't follow the process correctly, then even if you get to that right answer, you may end up having to hire that guy that you could have fired if you'd done it right back because you violated their due process. And everybody deserves due process, George, right? I mean, everybody. And so you got to do it right. And that takes time. And that's not necessarily what people want to hear, but it's true.
Yeah, sorry. You're saying also that you can't also have the community dictate how we do policing. From talking to some friends that are officers in this, like, states and across the different areas, a lot of them have been getting very frustrated with how it seems their departments and the upper brass and their mayors are bending their knee to the community in a lot of ways, where they're switching policy based off what the like public opinion, based off actual thought. And I know a few of them are very frustrated and thought about even turning in their badge. And I know other people that have turned in their badge due to bad cases of people mismanaging shootings and stuff like that's happening. And you're seeing people get fired. The sad truth is, the more I look at it, more officers, depending on the departments, are getting fired for doing the right thing. Such as, I forget the officer, I think he was in Kentucky. He got fired for not shooting a suspect, even though the guy didn't have any reason to be. And you also had that deputy up in, I think, Buffalo that got fired because she refused to fire a couple months ago. But then you have the same situation because of the strength of the unions, where bad cops are forced to stay on.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had any message for those good cops, but most of them are good cops that are getting frustrated with the system and like they don't know what to do.
Well, and what you're talking about when you say good cops is most of them.
Yeah, exactly.
The overwhelming majority of them, at least in my experience. Now, I was a cop. I wasn't going home with most of these people or going to bars with them or going to dinner or the park or whatever. So maybe I didn't see their complete persona. But you work 20 years in a police department of about 300. You get a pretty good take on all 300. And traveling around the country and in Canada as well, my experience was pretty much the same as what I experienced during my career. Good people who are frustrated. Now, you bring up two really good points. One is this idea that, you know, there's 9 good cops and 1 bad cop. And then the refrain you've been hearing out there is, well, if the 9 good cops don't do something about the 1 bad cop, then you have 10 bad cops. And if those 9 cops know that that cop is a bad cop and they have evidence of that, then I completely agree with that premise. But it's a flawed premise in general, because most of the time, the vast majority of the time, those 99%, they don't know in a I can prove it sort of way that there's something wrong with that 1%, that 10th cop or that 100th cop.
Because I agree. I don't think it's 10% either. I know tons of cops, and like I've never met one that I think's a bad one, but they're out there. We're seeing the news on it.
I had a 300 officer agency, another 100 and some civilians over a 20-year period. So, you know, obviously, however many people that ends up being, 1,000 people I worked with or whatever it is, I could probably think of 4 or 5 that if you showed me evidence of something criminal or bad that they had done, I would say that tracks. But I didn't have that information, or I would have done something with it.
And I think you agree, even that 4 and 5 is too many, though, when it comes to something.
I completely agree. But the problem is, if you're working on a platoon with another cop and you hear rumblings, oh, hey, that George, he's dirty, man. He's sleeping with hookers or stealing from drug dealers or whatever nefarious thing you want to say that he's doing. What am I supposed to do with that? Go tell my sergeant, hey, I heard a rumor that George, what's the sergeant going to say to me? Sergeant's going to say, do you have any direct knowledge of this? Well, no, I don't. It's a rumor. Okay. Well, you're going to go confront George about it? You know, I mean, what you have to realize is that at any moment, the reality of policing is that while it may not be the most dangerous job, depending on how you define it in the country, it is a dangerous job. And the real danger lies in that you never know. Most of the time when danger comes, you don't know it's coming until it's there. There are some situations where you know going in, especially a SWAT team situation, they know they're going into danger. But a lot of times you walk up on a car for a traffic stop and now you have danger. You knock on a door for domestic violence and now you have danger. And I don't mean run-of-the-mill danger. I mean the escalated life-threatening kind. When that happens, your radio is your best friend most of the time, right? I mean, a lot of times what you're going to say is, you know, I'm talking to George here and he's getting amped up. I see trouble coming. Start me another unit. Whoever's answering that is somebody that you work with every day. And you have to have that relationship to trust that they're going to come and when your life depends on it, and you're going to go when their life depends on it. So with those kind of things at stake, unless you have direct knowledge that somebody is doing something wrong, you're not going to rumor monger about it. In fact, rumor mongering is something that just devastates morale anyway. Now, I don't want anybody to take what I just said to excuse people who do have direct knowledge or are participants mm-hmm. and are not coming forward or not doing something about it. I mean, you look at the Chicago SOS story from the mid-2000s or Rampart or something like that. I'm not excusing anything like that. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that you can have one or two guys that maybe work together a lot, and maybe they both are doing some questionable things, but nobody else is aware of it and they're covering for each other. That doesn't make the other 12 cops on that platoon bad cops because they don't have that direct knowledge. If they do and they don't do something about it, tell a sergeant or tell a leader that can do something about it, and then the department doesn't do something about it, now you have corruption at a wider level more than just individual corruption.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that about cops, though, is like how often 99% of the time, but they're by themselves. They're in their cruiser. Yeah, they're...
depending on the agency, you have a lot of one-officer cars. We did. Doubling up and getting to ride with a partner was a luxury. It was a big deal. It was, hey, we're fat today. We got a lot. You know, nobody's on vacation. Nobody's sick. Nobody's on a detail. We got, you know, above minimum. So, yeah, sure, you can ride with somebody. And so it was a big deal. It was fun. A lot of agencies have that going on. And so, yeah, you're by yourself. You make a traffic stop, you're by yourself. The other thing you brought up was the police union. And I have mixed feelings on that as well, because, you know, when you ask someone to do an extraordinarily difficult job and you ask them to put themselves in harm's way, both physically, mentally, and legally, for the public good, I don't think it's inappropriate to necessarily inappropriate to, come along with that some qualified immunity. Otherwise, nobody's going to do this job. You think we have a recruiting problem now? If you don't have a little bit of like, hey, if you do your job and you do it according to policy and things go bad, you know, it's kind of a Good Samaritan sort of approach to policing. And that's altogether appropriate. The problem is that I worry about and that I've seen in some cases is police union, any union's job is to benefit its members. But sometimes you see the union protecting an individual member that by protecting that member to the degree that they are, I think they're damaging the rest of the membership. In other words, you make the entire police union look bad when you support and back up somebody who obviously did something wrong. And I don't know what the exact answer is, but there are some problems with the union. I was never a tried and true union guy. Now, I never got into any kind of a jackpot where I relied on the union either. So maybe I'd have a different attitude. I mean, the union is there to support the members, right? And without a union, you might get railroaded by management. You know, you might get beaten up pretty badly. And so I support the union, don't get me wrong, but I don't support unqualified support or unqualified protection of a member who's clearly all they should be protecting. If somebody's clearly violated the rules, is their due process. And I'm totally okay with that. Well, just like a defense attorney, make sure that their job is supposed to be to make sure that their client is fairly tried, right? That's a big element of their role, to make sure that you get a fair trial, that the procedures are adhered to, that and so forth. And that everything that needs to be put before the court on your behalf is put before the court. That a union should be doing that for its members when they're accused of something. A union should be negotiating for better wages. I get all of that. But a union shouldn't be protecting malfeasance. And so often in the news, that's when you see the union is because somebody obviously did something they shouldn't, and the union is firmly backing them. And a lot of the union I was in, there's a lot of dissension because of that, at least years ago.
So, because my big close experience with unions is like when I was in high school, I was being trained as a welder. So I got really close to like the Local 7, Local 17 iron workers and all that. So I have great respect for unions. But when I see certain things, like you said, unions are there to protect people. What they're not supposed to do is they're not supposed to set policy. Like one thing that drove me insane was when the head of the union in New York City started saying that, like, oh, because you want to tell our officers how to do something, like tell them to work slower and make less arrests. And I'm like, that's not your job as the union. Like if I was working for Local 7 and OSHA gave out a new like safety regulation and Local 7 said ignore OSHA, that's not your job as
right.
That's where I have a problem with the union. Exactly. It's...
And I, like I said, I am very pro police. I don't want anybody hearing this to think that I've turned in my blue at any stage of the game here. The police would love Well, just to finish off on unions real quickly, you know, in my state, we had binding arbitration, which meant if we couldn't reach a contract with the city, eventually after mediation, an arbiter would come in and binding arbitration would be the outcome. The reason for that, because we weren't allowed to strike, which made good sense, right? Public safety was an issue. You don't want to have striking cops. I think it's ridiculous. I never would have done it anyway, but, you know, it's a bad thing. So, you know, there's some give and take there, right? You guys can't strike, but we'll give you binding arbitration so you get treated fairly, that kind of thing. You know, I guarantee you that it was the union somewhere down the line, and I haven't researched this, so I might be just talking right out of my backside here, but I would be willing to bet serious money that it was a union somewhere down the line that got that benefit, you know, that at some point you can't strike and that's it. And the union said, well, hey, let's be fair. You know, if we can't strike, we should get binding arbitration. And that was probably hard won. And so I'm in favor of the union for those sorts of things. I'm just saying that just because you're a cop and you're part of a union, you shouldn't be shielded against bad actions, against malevolent actions. It's just not the way things should go.
All right. One thing, we're coming up actually on an hour now. I'm going to let my guests that are on ask some questions. If they don't have any questions, I have a few questions that some friends sent me. While they're waiting to write, did you have a book or piece of media that you wanted to promote?
Sure. I write a series of books with a co-author named Colin Conway, who was also a police officer in Spokane for 5 years. It's called the Charlie 316 series. The last book in that series, Code 4, comes out 11/23 of this year. And the series really explores some of the things that we've been talking about, noble cause corruption, race relations, the reality of policing. And then the other series I write is the River City series. And in that one, I really try to show what it is that cops go through at the line level. And then as the series progresses further up the line, you see scenes from that as well, you know. And in that series, especially, hey, the cops are the good guys. So if you hate cops, don't read that series. But they're not perfect. They make mistakes, they have weaknesses, and so forth. And so, you know, it's been called a paperback ride along by one reviewer. I think it gives a pretty accurate picture, if dramatized.
Thank you. For my media stuff that I'm going to say, first thing is the Rights and Wrongs podcast website is now up. We're now posting articles. If anyone's interested in writing an article, submit it and I'll send it to the editors. You can also buy some cool merch like this to help try and keep us alive. I'm sure you can confirm that running a podcast is not free. It does have some. It has some overhead. Also, it's coming close to the election. I'm not going to say who to vote for, but get out and vote. As I said last time, 25% of our law enforcement is actually run by sheriffs, and sheriffs are elected by you. So if you're having problems with your local county and like how things are going, learn how your law enforcement works. Every state's different, but get out and vote. Your state elections are just as important as the presidential election. I'm sure by now you know you want to vote for president. And I'll leave it at that. Looking right now, I don't have any new questions, but I did have one last question that you taught for International Sheriffs Association, correct?
It was the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Nonprofit or not for profit, I can't remember which, but it's a nonprofit organization that really their mission is to assist law enforcement across the country and actually internationally with every aspect of that. That includes training, it includes research, and it includes networking, you know, learning from each other. And one of their flagship courses is called Leadership in Policing, Leadership in Policing Organizations, LPO. It's a great course. It's a 3-week course in leadership, and it's geared towards leadership at every level in the organization. And it's been one that people have said is, it changes the way they see things. It's been very, it's been a watershed moment for a lot of people. And it was extremely gratifying to be part of that and to teach it in such diverse places as Albuquerque, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and then, you know, Vancouver, Calgary, Regina, Saskatchewan, you know, I mean, all over the country and in Canada, and to see people, see the similarities and differences in the police cultures there, but to see people really honestly examine things and talk about leadership in a meaningful way, and then apply the principles of human behavior that come out of that.
I wanted to ask, since you were taught both in the U.S. and Canada, is there any major differences between the two law enforcement styles, or is it just basically as one thinks Canada's like America light?
You know, if I were Canadian, I would resent that that description. I would
agree with that, but that's how a lot of people see it.
I would say that in general, the Canadian classes I went to were more receptive more quickly of the material, because some of the material is very challenging. It challenges your preconceptions. It challenges, you know, it does things like hearing defund the police do to police officers. Sometimes they hear something in the course early on and it sets them back and they kind of put their shields up a little bit. And I did find that the Canadian classes tended to work past that more quickly. But I'll tell you, there's a ton of similarities, and police culture is very similar across all of North America. It is affected and molded and nudged one direction or another by the local culture that they're part of. But what you find, it's almost like a language everybody speaks. When I went to Regina, Saskatchewan, I spoke cop and I was understood. When I went to Cleveland, Ohio, I spoke cop and I was understood. Went to Albuquerque, I spoke cop and I was understood, because there's a commonality, because the job is very similar, and the frustrations that come out of the job and the satisfactions that come out of the job and the dedication and the requirements, they're all very similar. And so the biggest difference, I think, on a practical level was that the Canadian police were not dealing with the proliferation — I have headphones on, I don't know if I said that right — proliferation of handguns that we are in the U.S. That's not to say that they're not there. It's not to say that they don't deal with them in the criminal element. They certainly do, but it isn't as widespread necessarily. And so that was a difference. As you might imagine.
Because I know Canadian gun law is closer to like Massachusetts, so like they have a lot of stuff like that. And their criminal justice system is a weird mix between British and American, which has merits. I think they do it well.
They do. They have some really good — there's a lot of things you could learn from Canadian law enforcement and apply to U.S. law enforcement and vice versa. But I will say that the Canadians, you know, they don't have the gun culture that the U.S. does. They just don't. It's a different, you know, it's 250 years of a different kind of culture. And I'm not saying there aren't gun lovers up there. I'm not saying guns don't exist. That's not my point. But here in the U.S., we have a very particular relationship with firearms. And if you travel around the world at all or talk to people who have, you'll see it's even more unique than you might otherwise realize. And so that has influenced the way policing has evolved. I think we're probably much quicker to pull our guns out in preparation for something bad. I mean, I can't count the number of times I drew my weapon while I was on patrol or as a detective. I can count the number of times I squeezed the trigger, you know, and that's probably true of most cops. You know, it very rarely happens that you fire your gun, but in most jurisdictions that I've talked to in the U.S., drawing it is a pretty low threshold, because you know how many guns are out there and that people have a propensity for using them. So you need to be ready. That's not quite as ingrained and not quite as true in Canada.
No, I would agree with that statement. Of everyone that I've met from like being in Europe, like a lot of people find it strange that like I have a license to carry. Like talking to people like, you own guns? Like, not anymore. I sold them to my friends before I moved to the UK. But it's like, to them, it's such a strange concept. The only two countries I can think that's close to American culture is maybe Russia and Finland.
So you can be — again, we've talked a lot about trying to find a middle ground on these topics. And I have my service weapon that I left when I left the department. They allowed me to purchase it, or it was a gift. I can't remember which. And I kept it and I still have it. It's within arm's reach right now. I was where I keep it, in my desk. You can be in favor of the Second Amendment. You can believe in that inherent right to bear arms, and also believe in reasonable gun laws that maybe strike that balance between individual freedom and the collective need.
That could be a whole nother podcast.
it certainly could, but the tie-in here is that it's not everybody should have any gun they want all the time, any gun whatsoever with no restrictions, and it's not fire all guns into the sun because they're evil. In my opinion, it's somewhere in the middle. Now, everybody's going to define where that middle ground should be differently. That's the political process. I'm just saying that a lot of positions are not mutually exclusive. Me saying that I support police and that police officers are good people, the vast majority of them, that they are doing the job for the right reasons, that they're doing a difficult job the best they can, and they're doing it for you, that statement can absolutely exist alongside me saying we need to reform how we're doing policing in the world, what we're asking our cops to do that other people maybe could be doing who are more equipped to do that, and thus removing a lot of the danger and the workload from the police officers so they can focus on those things that maybe should be in their bailiwick. Me saying we need police reform, law enforcement reform, can exist in the same world as my support for the police.
It's a great part. Like, you can see it across American politics right now, is that we forget that you can support an idea and critique an idea at the same time.
Right, right, right. I mean, I saw a quote the other day. I'll probably screw it up here, but it was, you have to understand to agree, but you don't have to agree to understand.
That's so, on my Instagram post, actually.
Was that you?
Yeah.
And it's a great idea. I mean, yeah, if you and I understand each other and we agree, that's wonderful. But if we disagree, but we still understand each other, then at least we're having an honest conversation.
Yeah.
And that's the first part to, you know, first step towards getting somewhere. And maybe we can find the middle ground that we need to find.
I'm going to finish this podcast right here. Did you have any final statements?
No, I just want to reiterate that, granted, my experience is biased. I was a cop and I worked around a lot of cops even after retirement. But the vast majority of those people that I have interacted with are good, good people who are working hard, who are dedicated, who are there for the right reasons, and who probably want some form of change in how we police as a society, just as much as you might. Asking them to do certain things that they may not be as well equipped to do as another professional, putting one more thing on their plate. I mean, I didn't even get into that, but the fact is do more with less is a losing proposition. You know, if you're going to put something on the plate, you got to take something off. And there are some things that police are doing that, quite frankly, could come off the plate and be done by someone else. And if that means you take the funding for that too, I don't think most police would carp if they're doing the job that they signed on to do and not some other job. And so it's through communication, it's through support, it's through honest conversation between the community and the police that we're going to get where we eventually want to be. And like any goal, we're never going to be perfect. We're never going to get to nirvana with this, but we're going to get a lot closer to what our ideal might actually be.
No, I completely agree. And like the main important about this is acknowledging bias, just because like when it comes to criminal justice, I'm pretty much 100% an academic. I have theory, I understand a lot of thought practice things, but I will never know what it's like to pull up in the middle of the night. Like, I've been on the receiving end of a traffic stop, but I've never been in their shoes, so I can only theorize. But both sides do have to have that conversation and try to understand the other, else we're just talking to walls.
And embracing the academic and embracing the practitioner or the experience, the classroom and the street is important. I mean, I've been in both. I've taught at the university and at the college level, community college, and online courses as well as the IACP course. And I've been on the street. And I can tell you that there are elements of both that if you draw them together, you'll have a much better viewpoint, a much stronger approach. It's not one or the other. It's not to sound like too much like Mr. Miyagi here, but it's about finding the balance, Daniel-san.
All right, well, I'm going to end it right there. Thank you so much for being part of this podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you'd probably also enjoy episode 4, where Professor Di Giovanni and I discuss many of the same subjects here, such as defunding the police and military influences. To hear more from Frank Scalise, join us on the next Sidebar segment, where we discuss his latest book series and what it's like to be a crime novelist. If you yourself would like to be on the podcast, feel free to email me at rightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com, all one word. If you prefer to be seen as in the written word than the spoken, we are now also launching an article section of the website. Just look at www.rightsandwrongspodcast.com and review the blog and the guidelines for posting. Thank you and have a great night.